now. It is my privilege to introduce our workshop leaders. Please help me offer a warm Tulare County welcome to our workshop leaders, Dan S. and Sheldon W. of Santa Monica, California.
Good morning, I'm Dan, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, I'm Sheldon Wolf, and I'm an alcoholic.
I want to welcome all you guys to the beginning of the Valley Speaker Series workshop. Obviously, you guys must be the serious ones to make it here this early in the morning. I think that we're going to start off with a little introduction, just to talk a little bit about ourselves, who we are, and how we came to this. But before I start, I would like to thank the Valley Speaker Series group for inviting us out here to do this. It's always a pleasure to be invited out to talk about our program. So, I'd like to start off by just saying that, you know, I always in the past had assumed that a spiritual awakening was supposed to feel good, whereas the fact is that some of the best feeling spiritual awakenings I've ever had, although moved me, I can't remember very many of them, if any. The spiritual awakenings that I seem to remember are the ones that instilled incredible pain in my life that changed the direction of my existence. Right? And for that, and that happened to me in 1987. I was sitting on my couch looking around my life thinking, what happened? You know, what happened? I had trashed another business. I had trashed a marriage. Had a car that was dying of alcoholism. I just looked around and said, something's got to change, right? Funny thing about powerlessness is you really don't experience depth of powerlessness until you try to do something and fail. Because it was at that point that I made some decisions in my life that I had to stop drinking. Right? Prior to that, I figured that the time and place would come when I would just stop. And it seemed that I got to that place. So 1987, sitting on that couch, I made that commitment to my life that I was going to stop drinking. Right? And I started to learn some more about the condition that I was suffering from, because for the next 2 years, I struggled with trying to stop drinking. I'd go to sleep telling myself, tomorrow I'll do better. And the next morning I would wake up, before I'd even open my eyes, the first thought that would come to my mind was, I'm going to get up and walk to the liquor store and buy some more whiskey. And I made that trip to the liquor store so many times that, you know, it was like, you know, I knew in the back of my mind that I made this commitment to my life to stop drinking. But I also knew that I was going to drink anyway. And it was from that place that I started to see the depth of my hopelessness. And and I continued to drink for the next 2 years until I finally bumped into a friend of mine that I used to drink with when I was a teenager. This was in 1989, 2 years after making that commitment to stop and failing. I almost didn't even recognize this guy. He really had to introduce himself again to me, and I didn't quite know what had happened to him, because he just looked completely different. See, this guy's name was Brian. See, he was a real alcoholic and a drug addict, and he was much worse than I ever was in the past. And, it was shocking to see him in this condition, and You know, he took me to my first meeting, and my life changed from that point on. I hit Alcoholics Anonymous like a bug hitting a windshield. I just stuck right from the very first meeting. And it was an interesting chain of events that happened. Brian was in Narcotics Anonymous, and I didn't necessarily relate to that program. Found myself in going to other programs right until I found my place at Alcoholics Anonymous. I had gotten I picked up a couple sponsors here and there along the way. Actually, five in my first year. I was special, and I just needed, you know, I needed a particular thing, and I was having trouble finding it. And it wasn't the steps that I was looking for. It was just somebody that would see how important I really am, and give me the time and the attention that I thought that I needed. So the good part was that I had exposure to a number of different things. Hospital pamphlets that one person made me fill out. They were kind of helpful in making me feel that I was doing something, but I filled out the questions that I figured applied and skipped over the rest of them. Autobiographical type of passes through the steps where you write, what do I think the step one is about, right? Gave me a lot of information that I already knew, and it was felt good to put it on paper, right? But again, didn't give me any new information. Didn't move me beyond where I was. There was checkbox inventories that many of you know are quite simple in what some of us are doing now. Did this apply? Yes. Check. Again, I felt really good finishing it, but it never gave me any real new information. It never moved me beyond where I was. Near the end of that first year, I wandered into a meeting in Santa Monica, and at the time it was called Steps 10, 11, and 12, because the current sponsor at that time that I had, we had zipped through the steps really quick, and I was in Step 10 and 11 now, and he said his instructions for 10 and 11 was go find an 11-step meeting. That was how I was supposed to do the 11th step. So I don't believe that that's all there is to the 11th step today, but that's what my instruction at the time was. But it turned out to be certainly something a lot bigger than what I would have expected, because when I opened up my book and looked in Santa Monica and I found this meeting, step 10, 11, and 12, I thought that's exactly what I was instructed to find. And so I was moved to this meeting. And it was, at the time, it was at 2nd and Hill Street in Santa Monica. And it's still my home group today. And that's where I met my sponsor, who was Joe H., who took me through the big book in a fashion that completely changed my life and many other people's. At this point, the meetings changed some from where it was. It started from a workshop where the majority of the meeting had come out of a workshop, so everybody was kind of on the same path. It's a different experience to be at a meeting that has a total common solution, not just a common problem, where everybody's pretty much doing things in a similar fashion. It was an exciting time. It's an exciting time because at this meeting you couldn't share unless you'd finished the ninth step. So you'd only ask questions. And that was fine with me because it was a very aggressive meeting. Crosstalk was allowed. they banter back and forth. It was like full contact AA. You know, they had a meditation before and after the meeting. I mean, before the meeting and the end of the meeting. They'd invite people to come speak, and then they'd hammer them with questions. Sometimes at the second meditation, you'd open your eyes and the speaker had left.
That's true.
So, we've got a lot nicer since then. It was an exciting place to grow up, though. So with that, I'm going to let Sheldon introduce himself.
Thank you, Dan. Yeah, my name is Sheldon Wolf, and I'm an alcoholic. It's an honor and a privilege to be here, and you guys clean up really well. My drinking took me to the streets. I was homeless for 3 years, and was definitely beat into a state of reasonableness, and I came to a point in my homelessness that I actually wanted to live for the first time in my life, and I didn't know how to do that. And I was introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous in 1985, and through the employee assistance program, they decided that I needed a little bit of help, and I worked for a pretty good company at that time. I was working for Hughes Helicopter, my work did not start till noon, and everybody knew that, and I worked twice as hard as everybody else because I didn't get anything done until I could get a drink. And that was how my working career kind of went. At noon, I would take my Fiero and drive 100 miles an hour, literally down this private road we had, and I would go to the bar, and I'd order 2 Long Island iced teas, and then I would get 4 club Long Island iced teas. I don't know if you ever remember the little club drinks. And I would get 3 of those, and that would get me kick-started so that I could actually get the shakes off and start working. And so I ended up in a recovery facility. They used to call them care units. And I stayed in that care unit for 2 weeks, and they gave me a big book. And I think the bill was $42,000. So it was the most expensive big book I ever had. I threw it away, and I continued on doing what I was doing. And so my introduction to Alcoholics Anonymous started from that care unit, and there were panels that came in, and we went to outside meetings, and I kind of felt that there was something there, but I really wasn't interested in doing the step deal. And the years went on, and I kept getting 30 days. I was really good at getting 30 days and then celebrating. And I had so many 30-day chips I could tile a bathroom, I swear. And a couple of them weren't kosher either. I had 29 days, and I felt I needed to have a drink a little sooner than 30 days. So I was really into the chip taking process. I thought it was great. Everybody applauded for me, and I got more attention being a newcomer. And I really loved that attention. So they pat me on the back. It's going to be okay. Everything's fine. You know, you're in the right place. And, you know, I really didn't know if I was in the right place or not. I knew that I drank a shitload of alcohol, but I didn't know that I was really an alcoholic. So that venture took me through 7 different treatment centers. In one of them, I was in for 60 days, and it was a 30-day program. And I was drinking in the facility. We'd go to a meeting, my friend would bring me a pint, and I would sit in. It was a meeting, maybe some of you are familiar in L.A., 26 and Broadway. So he would come and bring me a pint. I would sit in the bathroom, and I would drink that pint in the meeting because they wouldn't do a breath test on me or any of that stuff if I was to leave on a visiting pass. So, and I met the girl of my dreams there, and we played house for a while. We ended up in Peoria, and I ended up trying to commit suicide in Peoria. I took 100 Valium and drank a gallon of gin, and I ended up being in a coma for 3 days, and they had me on a lockdown, and I couldn't get out of there. So finally I got out of there. I got a plane ticket to come back to L.A., and I had nowhere to go, and that's when I ended up on the streets. And I panhandled. I was ass end up in a lot of dumpsters. I drank Mad Dog 2020 on a full moon night in the alley and howling at the moon practically every night. And I ended up in this place called it was in Hollywood. It was a drug and alcohol center, and they had meetings there, and I knew about meetings. I had gone to so many meetings and took so many chips, and I heard so many stories, and I just didn't know what it was about. I knew there was more than what I was seeing, but I just didn't know what it was. And so I detoxed in this drug and alcohol center, going to meetings. I went to OA meetings, I went to CA meetings, I went to CODA meetings. I mean, they had every meeting, and I just didn't leave. I was just, every meeting that came in, I stayed. And they didn't kick me out, so that was a good place to be. So I ended up going to a homeless shelter in Pasadena, and I met a man, and what he said really perked my interest. He said, "I can't get sober and I can't get drunk." And I understood that. I understood what he was talking about, because I was the same way. I couldn't get sober and I couldn't stop drinking. I mean, I couldn't stay stopped. So I ended up going up to Acton, which is a facility up near Lancaster, and I stayed there. Another 30-day program I stayed 60 days for. And I was very familiar with Tuesday night that Dan was talking about on 2nd and Hill. And I had gone to a couple of meetings there when I got sober. And I really liked what they had to say, but they were really overdoing a lot of this stuff. They were not that friendly. They didn't welcome me like most meetings, and they didn't clap for me. They didn't give chips, and I was just very, very, very disappointed in this group of people. They were actually mean, and so I was very attracted to that. It was different. It was very, very different, and I felt that they had some substance to what they were talking about in the meetings, and there was depth and weight. The book talks about a message of depth and weight is what can hold an alcoholic, and they had a message of depth and weight. And so I went to that meeting for a little while, and I got somebody to work with me, and I ended up drinking after 3 years of sobriety in the middle of a four column inventory, and I was in the fourth column. And again, I had two death experiences after drinking. It's a very I don't suggest to start this work and then to drink in the middle of this work. It's actually better if you just don't start. Just finish your drinking. But I ended up drinking in the middle of that fourth step, and it was a very powerful relapse. I mean, it was just really powerful. I was literally drinking to die. And there's a story in the book that he was went to a farmhouse and he hid in that farmhouse to drink himself to death. Well, that's what I was doing in this room. I was hidden in this room and I was drinking myself to death. And they came and got me out of that room and they took me up to Acton. That's when I went up to Acton. And stayed up at Acton and came back down, and I knew that meeting existed. I had Marlboro everything. I was saving Marlboro miles when I was homeless. I had a Marlboro backpack. I had a Marlboro jacket. I had a Marlboro sleeping bag and a Marlboro, because everybody would throw them away. I'd go to the car wash, and everybody would throw away their cigarette packs there, and I would collect the miles. So I ended up on the porch of Tuesday night, and I'm sitting there, and I had all this backpack stuff, and everybody knew who I was. And again, they weren't really friendly. They said, "What's going on?" You know, I said, "I don't have anywhere to stay. Do you guys know where I could stay?" And I ended up staying in this little crazy house. I had a little 8 by 10 room. It was as big as my king size bed, and I stayed in there, and I ended up going to this meeting a lot, and I asked Joe Hawk to sponsor me, and he said no, and I thought you couldn't turn down an AA request, but I wasn't that attractive for his AA resume because I was a chronic relapser. I relapsed within this meeting doing some of this work, and I just wasn't that attractive to be a sponsee. The story is that he was in a piece of work that was very powerful, and he was asked to stop speaking and to stop working with others. And if you knew Joe Hawk, that was a big deal in his life. He spoke all over the country, all over the world, and he sponsored hundreds of people. He was very, very dedicated to this work and to helping others. And for him to say no, was later on I found, was a very powerful moment for him. And I ended up, this guy was sharing about his anger, and he was an artist, and I went to one of his art shows, and he had these paintings that depicted my anger out on the canvas. And I said, "How do you get this out of you? How do you get this? I want to get that out of me, and I want to put it on some sort of canvas." And he said, he started talking to me about the steps, and he was the first person to ever really pay any attention to me in that group. And one day I knew I was going to drink. I was 90 days sober, and I knew I was going to drink. You just know, right? You know when you're going to drink. I was going to drink. And I said, "Will you sponsor me?" He says, "I don't know if I will or not. Let me consider it." And I grabbed him by the shirt. He was a little guy. And I grabbed him by the shirt, and I threw him up against the wall, and I said, "I'm going to drink. I need your help." And he said, "Please put me down." And so I put him down, and he took me to a restaurant. He took me to Norm's and got me a piece of apple pie and a milk. And I guess he thought that was something that would calm me down, and it did. And he wrote a prayer on a napkin, and he said, "I want you to say this prayer every day and every night." And that was all he told me to do. So I read this prayer every day and every night. And he didn't call me and set up an appointment or nothing. So I called him. I said, "What's the deal? I'm doing this prayer and I've done it diligently." He said, "Will you sponsor me?" He said, "I don't know, but let's come over and we'll talk." So I went through the process of the 12 steps. And I was so beaten up. It wasn't about having the best sponsor, being in the best meeting, and hanging around the best people in fellowship. What it was about is that I was dying, and I didn't want to die, and I wanted to live. And I was on this life and death errand, and that's what alcoholism was for me, life and death. And that's what beat me into the state of reasonableness, is that I did want to live, and I didn't know how to live, and I was afraid to live. Tried to commit suicide
as I said several times, very, I don't know how I didn't die in those moments. They were very serious attempts. And so I went through the steps. I had a spiritual awakening. And I had a spiritual awakening in the first step. And a spiritual awakening, I thought, was something really brilliant and bright, you know, and something just opens up the skies and rainbows come down with angels playing harps and, you know, it's just going to be this really beautiful experience. And the experience I had in the first step was I saw the truth about my alcoholism. That was my first spiritual experience in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I think that anybody who sees a piece of truth who's a real alcoholic, that's a spiritual experience, because I don't see the truth. I'm full of delusion and illusions of what my life is. I was standing straight up, walking, looking at you in the eyes, dreaming I was alive. I was totally asleep. And I started to wake up that very moment I saw that I was a real alcoholic, and I went through the whole process. And what ended up happening is I ended up having an intimate relationship with God. I started having an intimate relationship with myself, and I started to have intimate relationships with other people. And that occurred in the fifth step. Now I'm dedicated to working with others and doing things like this to carry this message, a common problem with a common solution. And I think that's really important. Thanks.
So Sheldon mentioned a prayer that he was asked to write down on a piece of paper. And I lost my glasses. The some of you have seen that prayer. I think. Yeah. Who's mine?
Yeah, yeah.
I thought I had. I was like, what did I do with them? Okay. Sheldon mentioned a prayer that he was asked to consider. You know, we come to this process with a lot of ideas, a lot of assumptions. Sometimes the longer you're in Alcoholics Anonymous, the more you think you know about Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm not saying that anything that you've heard anywhere else is bad, you know, because certainly you pick up a lot of good things along the path, especially if you've been around the program for a while. I mean, I've worked with people with more time than I have, and so obviously there's a lot good going on. But one of the things that becomes an obstacle along this path is old fixed ideas, and it's helpful to start a process with an open mind, start a process like this with an open mind, especially if you haven't been taken through the big book before. The prayer that we were given to start this process with goes like this. God, help me set aside everything I think I know for an open mind and a new experience. And there's a number of different variations of that, and there is references to it in the big book, not necessarily written like that, but there is certainly plenty of references to things like the result was nil until we let go of our old ideas. Anyway, there's a number of different references to coming to this thing with an open mind. It's something that I give everybody to start with that I'm working with. So, did you want to sure of it, Timothy.
Yes, and that prayer was a very powerful moment in my life because I knew so much about Alcoholics Anonymous. I knew so much about the Big Book at that time, and I really was filled with a lot of information and self-knowledge, and it really broke that up. Like when the ice breaks in Alaska and the river starts to flow, I started to have movement in my life. So what really attracted me was when I got to the title page. I've never read the title page of any book before in my life. I've always gone to page one. And I think that's pretty normal. People just skip the, you know, prefaces and the contents and they start reading the first page or chapter one. So I was shown the title page and the first thing it says is Alcoholics Anonymous. And my sponsor told me at the time that this was a promise, Alcoholics Anonymous. And why was it a promise? Because right below it, it says the story of how many thousands of men and women have recovered. And recovered is a promise for me because they kept telling me in the other meetings that I was going to at that before I had gotten sober that I'll always be recovering. I will stay sick, but I will always be recovering. And that wasn't a very interesting message to me. So I never saw the title page, and I saw this, and he showed me. He said, this is the very first promise in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And there's not just the nine-step promises that they read all of the time. There's promise right from the gate how many thousands of men and women have recovered from alcoholism. And that really strikes me still today. And I was shown this circle and triangle. It's been removed from the book for legal reasons and different things that weren't done where they could have it as the logo. I don't want to get into all of that. But it's still interesting how AA removed it. And but I made a stamp that I stamp books with the circle and triangle of the original. So what is the circle and triangle anyway? What I was told, it's an ancient religious symbol. And the triangle is a trilateral. It's equal sides. It's an equal-sided triangle. It's balanced. And the circle around the triangle had also has meaning. So the original was that it was body, mind, and spirit. And I was to become whole mentally, physically, and spiritually. And that's the circle around the triangle. The triangle is the base of body. And the of mind, and unity is body and service is spirit. So body, mind, and spirit. So I take my mind to the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I take my body to meetings and functions like this. And then I take my awakened spirit into the world. So the 12 steps is where I take my mind. The 12 traditions is where I take my body. And the 12 concepts of service is where I take my spirit. And each one of those things have direction. They have directions on how to find a spiritual path in that direction. So in recovery, I go through the 12 steps. As they're outlined in the book, and I can recover. And what that looks like for me is I thought recovery was about
getting myself better and getting well, and that I could be have a normal life. And what I found out is the 12 steps take me to a place where I become helpful to the people about me, and that it wasn't for me. And I was always in recovery and unity. I never really did any service because I thought the whole process was about me getting well and getting a job and having a family and the things that I've always wanted to have. And so as I recovered from the 12 steps, and I did a lot of fellowship and going to a lot of meetings, meetings became a different thing for me. I used to go to meetings to get something. I thought the 12 steps were for me to get something. But the truth is the 12 steps awakened me that I can go into meetings and carry a message instead of getting a message. And the power of that is that I have a selfless attitude in my life to just be of service to the people about me. And I don't know. There's so much I want to say about this, and we just got so much time. But I think that kind of lays it out simply.
A lot of times I get asked to help somebody who's been in the program for a while, and some of them have even gone through the book, and they come to me and they say, Dan, my life's upside down. I don't know what's happening. I've already done this work. I finished amends. I did this and that and whatever. And so the circle and triangle becomes really useful, not only from in the beginning to talk about what Alcoholics Anonymous is, but to talk about, to discuss it with somebody who's been in the program for a while. And because the circle and the triangle talks about unity, recovery, and service. Unity being the fellowship, recovery being the 12 steps, and service for me being working with others. So I like to start the discussion with that person with, what's Alcoholics Anonymous? Right? And they generally look at me funny, like, that seems like it would be an odd question. But because most people know what Alcoholics Anonymous is, right? It's the meetings, the fellowship, it's the 12 steps in recovery, right? And it's the service side, which is working with others. Some people say the service side is commitments and the stuff you do around Alcoholics Anonymous. Big Book doesn't really talk about all of that. The service that the Big Book talks about is working with others. I'm not saying that all that other stuff is important, but I like to group that with the fellowship. My commitments to the meetings is my participation in the fellowship. So I ask them a simple question. Do you have a home group? Right? A lot of times people hang around a while and they get into life and they start to get more involved in the life AA gave them than AA, right? So I find a lot of people that are having trouble in their life start to focus on other things. So I say, where are you at with the fellowship? Do you have a home group? Are you committed to a group? A lot of times people say yes, but then when you get to the next question, where are you at with the 12-step process that you already are familiar with? Right? Are you doing 10 and 11? Are you working with others still? Right? Where are you at in your 12-step recovery process? At that point, it starts to get a little hazier for those people. Right? It's because I start to feel good, and all of a sudden 10 and 11 start to drop away. And then there's the service side. You know, are you working with others? That's when it really falls off. It really falls off. So you've got this, as Sheldon said, an equal triangle, and a triangle with three equal sides, yet it's leaning sometimes heavy in the fellowship, or for some people it's leaning heavy in working with others, or some people just want to live in meditation or whatever. But what I'm saying is that what I found is that a balance of all three of these things, right, commitment to the fellowship, participating in the 12 steps, whatever step that I'm actually on, even if it's 10, 11, and continuing to work with others, those things put me into a place that's conducive for a way of life that has a sense of wholeness to it. So it becomes a really good test to, you know, where am I in Alcoholics today? Where am I in Alcoholics Anonymous today? All right. What does my program look like? So with that, I think we should move on to, I'm going to talk about the contents page. In my book, I got a third edition here. It's page V. The Roman numerals from the preface through the forewords, for lack of a better word, I call them the general information. One of the things that that makes it a little bit more complicated for some people is it doesn't actually say here is step one, here is step two, right? When you get to step three, there's a reference to it, and from then on, it tells you what step you're in. But it doesn't. It's not clear for someone who doesn't have someone showing them or guide through the book where step one is. And I think that has a tendency to make the 12 and 12 more attractive to some people, because you say, okay, here's step one, here's step two, here's step three. The problem is, if you read the 12 and 12, and you look at step one, there's four pages. It doesn't talk about the physical craving. It doesn't talk about all of the different things that we look at in step one. I don't know how I would take somebody through the 12 and 12 to go through the steps. You could look at it for yourself. You know, it'll take you 10 minutes to read the four pages.
There's really no instructions in that. Yeah.
So in the original first edition book, the doctor's opinion was page one. That's where they wanted us to start. And so I look at step one in three parts: the physical craving, the mental obsession, and the unmanageability. I find step one, physical part of the problem, from the doctor's opinion through to the top of page 23, and then from 23 to 43, I look at the mental obsession, and I look at the unmanageability in step one on page 44, 45, and 52. We agnostics is where I look at step two. So from then on, it's going to tell you where the steps are. So that's how the book is laid out for me, and how I proceed through it. I think that there's a lot of things as you're going through step one, a lot of references to things other than just, like in the physical part, there's still references to things like God and other things. But as I'm going through, I try to keep a focus of those are things that they're talking about, things that I obviously don't have. So the contents page is good to lay out basically this plan of action. how it works is going to be step 3 and 4. Into action is 5 through 11. And working with others is step 12. So I'd like to start making a point here. Okay, on the bottom of the 4 at XVI, do you have anything to say about this, or do you want me to do the whole thing?
Yeah, just go ahead.
Okay, we're going to back up a little bit. Sorry. Forward to the first edition, XIII. It says something important here. It says in the first paragraph, we of Alcoholics Anonymous are more than 100 men and women who have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. I think that's an important point. Here it tells me what it is that we recover from. And it goes on to say, to show others, other alcoholics, precisely how we have recovered is the main purpose of this book.
And that's important because it's squiggly lines. I was always like, why did they put those squiggly lines there? Because it's really important.
It also references in that bottom of that paragraph, says we are sure that our way of living has its advantages for all. It's not our way to quit drinking. It's our way of living. Just not drinking is not enough for me. I need a way of life conducive for staying sober, not just getting sober. So I'm XV, looking forward to the second edition. It says, the spark that was to flare into the first AA group was struck in Akron, Ohio in June 1935 during a talk between a New York stockbroker, Bill Wilson, and an Akron physician, Dr. Bob Smith. 6 months earlier, the broker had been relieved of his drinking obsession by a sudden spiritual experience following a meeting with an alcoholic friend, that was Ebbie Thatcher, who comes to Bill in his story, who had been contacted with the Oxford group of that day. He had also been greatly helped by the late Dr. William D. Silkworth, a New York specialist in alcoholism who is now counted no less than a medical saint by AA members, and whose story of the early days of our society appears in the next pages. That's the doctor's opinion. So the Oxford group was a kind of a fundamentalist Christian organization. Excuse me. At the time that Ebbie had been involved in, Ebbie was the one that came to Bill to carry the Oxford group message to him, right? And that was really helpful to Bill. But Bill's also saying here is that he had greatly been helped by Dr. William D. Silkworth, the New York specialist on alcoholism, who we're going to talk about it in what the doctor says in the doctor's opinion. From the doctor, the broker had learned the grave nature of alcoholism. And what it says next is interesting. It says, though he could not accept all the tenets of the Oxford group, he was convinced of five things, right? And if you, depending on which book you have, it's 292 or 263. Depends what edition book. If it's a newer book, I think it's 263. there's an idea of what they started with in the beginning of Alcoholics Anonymous. These aren't actually the tenets of the Oxford group, but they were taken from those six tenets. But it's listed in six things here. What it says is he was convinced of the need for moral inventory, confession of personal defects, restitution to those harmed, helpfulness to others, and the necessity of belief in dependence upon God. So that, there's five things here. But it says, again, he could not accept all the tenets of the Oxford group. The one thing that's missing from this part of the paragraph is the first one, complete deflation. Right? He couldn't accept complete deflation just from what the Oxford group was showing him. The Oxford group, being what it was, is you come to the, it was a religious organization, and you come to the Oxford group ready to give yourself to God. Right? But what it says, I'll start reading from the last paragraph. The physician had repeatedly tried spiritual means to resolve his alcoholic dilemma, but it failed. We're talking about Dr. Bob Smith now. When Bill first had that meeting with Dr. Bob, what Bob was relating to, I think, was the same thing as what Bill was relating to, was the idea that he couldn't accept complete deflation. Right? Because it says, but when the broker, Bill Wilson, gave him Dr. Silper's description of alcoholism and its hopelessness, our step one, the physician began to pursue the spiritual remedy for his malady with the willingness he had never before been able to muster. So the point here is that it seems that both Bill and Bob can relate to the idea that they couldn't just turn to a higher power. Right? They just couldn't turn to God without completely understanding what was wrong with them. And it was Dr. Silkworth's ideas that helped both of them to get to a place of complete deflation. So I think what that tells me is that it's to the degree that I see my hopelessness and desperation, right, is to the same degree that I'm going to lean into a program that's going to direct me towards power in my, greater than myself in my life. As long as I think I can do any of this myself, it's going to be harder to turn to a spiritual program for a solution. But when faced with complete desperation, complete hopelessness, complete understanding of what is it that I need God in my life for, right? It's at that point that I could lean into a spiritual program like my life depends on it.
Yeah, I think another point with the Oxford groups is they weren't alcoholics. They were a group of people, the Rockefellers and Uniroyal Tires and all of those people. They wanted to revise first century Christianity. They wanted to start teaching principles rather than giving rules. And they had felt that the churches had been giving rules rather than teaching principles, because their congregations were getting really huge and it was hard to teach a principle. So they give you rules. And rules can be broken, but you can't break a principle. Like the principle that water freezes at 32 degrees. You can't change that. And that's what this whole process is about principles. And that you can't change it or bend it or make it into something that fits your ideal.
So with that, what it's going to lead us into then is we're going to talk some about what exactly the doctor's opinion is. And that's where we're going to see this beginning of step one. Because obviously, if it was important enough for them to put it in the front of the book, and for it to originally be page one in the book, it was important enough to them, right, to do that. And he says in the forewords here that was the thing that shifted them both into that place of desperation. So what we're going to do at this point is we're going to take a 10-minute bathroom break, and we're going to start here promptly at 9:10. And at the same time, that's so that the taper can...